Hey everyone, it's Billy Morrison and Ozzy Osbourne here. Our new show, The Madhouse Chronicles, is dropping this April. Join us as we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Visit osbournemediahouse.com for early access. What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
Oh,
you're in the madhouse now.
Podcast for all things strange and unusual, sometimes dreary, sometimes dirty, sometimes drafty, but always super weird. My name is Ashley, and I am your host this week as we ramp up to season 8 of our show. This week, I wanted to show you just what you were missing over on our Patreon at www.patreon.com/keepitweirdpodcast. Over the last few months, we've had deep dives into death and dying experiences and Charles Manson. We've had guests come on the show to tell us about some strange things they've experienced in their lives, and I figured out how to use a soundboard. Which is either going to be the best thing that's ever happened to us, or it's going to be very annoying. Either way, I cannot wait to get my greasy little fingers all over those keys in the next season of our show, which actually looks like it might premiere on my freaking birthday. Wow, what a special day for me. March 22nd, or worst case scenario, the 29th is what we're aiming for. Oh my God, that's Good Friday. And what a Good Friday it will be if that's when the season premiere comes out. Listen, there's a lot going on in our lives, and we will be catching you guys up in our season premiere. But for now, let's take a sneak peek at our Patreon. Our first clip comes from Lauren's February episode titled Dreaming, Delusional, or Deathbed, in which she researches some believers and skeptics' takes on what happens at the moment of our death. Take a listen.
Stories about shared death experiences have been circulating since the late 19th century, according to people who are studying the phenomenon, which, hello, what, where have I been? But the twist in shared death stories is that it's not just the people at the edge of death that get a glimpse, but those near them. Whether it's physical, emotional, they are experiencing something in the sensations of dying. These shared death accounts come from all kinds of sources. Soldiers watching comrades die in the battlefield, hospice nurses, people holding vigil at the bedside of their loved ones, just like in my dad's story. They all tell similar stories with the same kind of message, that people do not die alone. Somehow they find a way to share their passage to the other side in one way or another, which, again, at the end of the day is what Julia always says when she talks about her hospice experience, which that's why I love hearing her stories. Hello, helicopter, Los Angeles, you're getting noisy. I really appreciate her stories because I love the way she says things about death and how it doesn't seem lonely. It does seem like you're greeted by someone or something, or you're able to share in the experience with whoever is near. Like, how special to, like, find a comfort in death, because I know a lot of us struggle with it, and I know we don't want to lose our loved ones, so I don't know. I really like this idea of having a little bit of comfort, a little bit of hope to hold on to, that maybe it won't be so scary when we have to go, because I know that I have anxiety about it. I want to accept death as just being so normal and part of life. And honestly, I've experienced so much death around me, from family members to very close friends, even traumatic deaths that happened to a good friend of mine in college. It's just, I feel like it's been around enough that, like, maybe I should have some more accepting feelings, relaxed nature about it. But I mean, I have anxiety. I can't get around that. I'm an anxious person. So I don't know. It's hard for me to get past the scared feelings, but I do enjoy these stories. And I feel like that's why I'll continue to talk about it. And that's why I will beg Julia to come on this show and talk about it with me, because I think there is a small comfort there, and hopefully it'll only get better for me in my brain and for others, I hope too. So a man named Raymond Moody introduced the concept of the shared death experience in his 2009 book called Glimpses of Eternity. He first started collecting stories of people who died and returned to life while he was in medical school. Skeptics, of course, have dismissed tales of the afterlife as hallucinations triggered by anesthesia or anoxia, which is a loss of oxygen to the brain that some people will experience when they're close to death. But Moody says you can't explain away shared death experiences by citing anoxia or anesthesia. We can't do that because the bystanders are not ill, they're not injured, and yet they are experiencing the same kind of things. Skeptics, again, will say people reporting shared death experiences are not impartial observers. Their perceptions are distorted by grief. Specifically, a man named Joe Nickel, he is a noted investigator into the paranormal, says that people who've watched others die sometimes experience their own form of trauma, and this is how they are coping with it. And honestly, sure. You know, like, there is something going on in the brain that is helping us cope. I believe that. Our body, our brain builds up that defense in any way it can. I know that trauma is dealt with in such unique ways, so sure. So Joe Nickel is saying people don't intend to. They're not trying to lie. They're not trying to reinvent anything, but they are trying to make this moment of their loss more acceptable in some way, and that is kind of the hallucination in their brain. If you're having a death vigil and your loved one dies, wouldn't it be great to have an awesome story to tell that would make everyone feel happy? You could go, Uncle John went to heaven and I saw his soul leave and I saw him smile. This is how Joe Nickel talks about the shared death experience. He's an investigative writer for the Skeptical Inquirer, which offers scientific evaluations of extraordinary claims, which we love a healthy skeptic. So slay, let's get it. But I just have to put that in because, of course, people are going to question this. And I always want to, you know, speak to both sides. So, of course. If you're looking for something hard enough, you'll find it. Any psychologist or psychiatrist would say the same thing. The term shared death experience may be somewhat new, but it went by different names centuries ago. The Society for Psychic Research in London documented shared death experiences in the late 1800s, dubbing them deathbed visions or deathbed coincidences. This is what researchers are saying. So it's been around for a while. It's gone under different names, but basically people have been reporting this phenomenon for a long time, not knowing what to call it. And people are like, okay, deathbed, like you're seeing something. The deathbed coincidence. Okay, grandma was dying. Little Billy was sitting next to her. He was floating above the bed with granny, saw some angels. What are we going to do? Deathbed coincidence, of course. So this has been going around. It's feeling brand new to me, obviously. I'm like, hello. Maybe everyone has known about this but me, but I am loving reading about this. But anyway, it's been evolving. It's being talked about, and I'm excited to know more. Crisis apparitions refers to visits by the spirits of the recently departed, I guess. This was also part of some of the research where it's like, oh yeah, crisis apparitions, this is totally a thing. They're very chilling. Some say they can be comforting, but I really think this is just a hallucination. This is totally just the brain tricking itself. Crisis apparition, like not real, not anything that we need to be worried about. But one of the first shared death experiences to gain attention kind of went this way. It came during World War I from Karl Scala, a German poet. Scala was a soldier huddled in a foxhole with his best friend when an artillery shell exploded, killing his comrade. He felt his friend slump down into his arms and he died. In the book, Parting Visions, an author Melvin Morse described what happened next to Scala, who had somehow escaped injury. He felt himself being drawn up with his friend above their bodies and then above the battlefield. Scala could look down and see himself holding his friend. Then he looked up and saw a bright light and felt himself going toward it along with his friend. Then he stopped and returned to his body. He was uninjured except for hearing loss that resulted from the artillery blast. So, that one was from quite some time ago, but it's been written about in a couple of different books and kind of goes along with the more recent stories that we're starting to hear. So Raymond Moody, who I referenced before, who coined the term shared death experience, has arguably done more than any contemporary figure to rekindle secular interest into the afterlife. He's been dubbed the father of near-death experiences. He introduced this experience in, you know, to popular culture in 1975 in his book Life After Life. And he says he just kept hearing stories about shared death experiences during his research. And when he was, you know, writing this book, and he was a very chatty man, he talked to anyone that he could, and he would put these stories in the book, and then he would also talk about them in lectures, and he was going round and round preaching the word of shared death experiences and saying that, hey, these need attention too. Near-death experiences get most of the attention because they are a bit more disturbing. It's, you know, from the person themselves who we maybe had to witness almost dying. You know, we see someone laying on the ground, not breathing, and then they come back with a story of going to the light. Like, that is wild. But then how are we supposed to believe someone who was just sitting at the bedside when they say they were floating and going towards a light and smiling at the person who was passing? Like, we have to take their word for it. They didn't go through anything close to death. They were just sitting in a chair in the hospital. But, I don't know. I almost think there's something more wild to this story, but I do get it. Where's the evidence? What do we do?
It's funny. Joe and I were just talking about this a few weeks ago about how, like, all of these skeptics come in with their opinions on the matter, and that's all well and good. But I'm sorry. I'm 100% going to take the word of hospice nurses and ER nurses who experience death on a regular basis before I listen to someone who has maybe never even seen someone die in front of them. Might be a hot take, but that's what you're here for, right? Hot takes? Hot takes? Cool treats? That's Dairy Queen. Here is a not-so-cool treat for you, a short clip from a book report that I did this month on chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s by Tom O'Neill. How many ways was Charles Manson connected to the CIA? At least four are uncovered in chaos. The apprentice who styled hair under Jay Sebring, he received a call from a mobster who was also an informant the day after the murders, telling him that everything was going to be okay. This was a guy that Jay Sebring not only serviced as a stylist, but also partied with in Las Vegas and Chicago. That's one. There was also a man who hung around the family whose whereabouts cannot be accounted for the evening of or the morning after the murders on Cielo Drive, who made a phone call informing one of Sharon Tate's friends of the murders before the maid arrived and made the discovery and ran screaming to the neighbors to call the police. This man also threatened one of Bugliosi's witnesses with deportation into testifying something that said witness did not remember happening. That's sus. And finally, my all-time favorite Manson connection to the CIA. This took place actually years before the murders, up in San Francisco during the Summer of Love in 1967. This is where Charlie discovered LSD. This is where Charlie became a hippie. Before this, he was just an ex-convict. He didn't have long hair. He didn't walk around shoeless. He was just an ex-con who had been in and out of jail since he was a teenager. This is also where he started the family. And This is where he and his girls visited the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic on a weekly basis, getting their STDs treated for free. The Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic was run by two Smiths. Two men named Smith, Roger Smith, who also happened to be Charlie Manson's parole officer. Manson was his only parolee. And David Smith. Both men were receiving private and federal grants to conduct drug research there, specifically LSD. Even more specifically, LSD, mind control, and violent group behavior. So they were essentially studying the exact recipe that would result in the Manson family murders multiple years before it took place. And not only that, they were studying the group of people that would go on to commit those murders. And this was funded by the federal government. Well, you know, secret factions of the federal government the government didn't know about until many years later. But it could explain why there's a huge cover-up surrounding this crime. And that's the thing about the book, is that like he said, like I said earlier as well, Tom does not at any point say, like, this is what happened the night of the murders, or this is what led up to the murders. But what he does say is that, like, the story that we were given is not correct. Like, something else was going on.
Woof.
This book was absolutely bananas to read. I have now read 4 full books on Charles Manson: Helter Skelter, Manson, The Family, and now Chaos. And I have to say, Chaos is my favorite. Speaking of favorites, every month I get to hang out with one of my favorite people of all time, my Patreon co-host of many years now, Amy Hanselman, and we got to start doing monthly weird reports. We share weird news headlines and strange current events, updates on true crime cases, upcoming horror movies, TV shows, documentaries, etc. that you should be on the lookout for, and we share some very scary real life stories. Here is a clip from February's weird report, A Farmer You Could Never Forget. There is also, this is fun, there's a pregnant stingray named Charlotte. Have you seen TikToks about this?
I have not seen TikToks, but I do know about Charlotte.
Okay. So Charlotte is in the aquarium and shark lab in North Carolina, who has not shared a tank with a male stingray in over 8 years, but she is very pregnant. She will have 4 pups literally any minute now. I checked earlier today. No pups yet. And the thing is, she hasn't been around males in 8 years. So they're like, holy shit, how this – they thought they were overfeeding her. And it turns out they kind of were overfeed. She was eating more, but it's because she was very pregnant.
She's pregnant.
She's a pregnant baby. And some people online, like I saw this on TikTok and I was like, whoa, what? Some people were speculating she could have been impregnated by one of the male sharks. She has like small mm-hmm. male sharks in her tank. But experts say that's not possible. Their sexual parts don't even add up to each other, and also their DNA is completely different. So it definitely wasn't the sharks. And then other people were like, oh, she cloned herself, but that's actually not true either. She didn't clone herself. She's probably undergoing parthenogenesis, a form of asexual reproduction where offspring develop from unfertilized eggs. All female, baby. They'll probably be all female.
Yeah. I love that.
Which, the future is female in stingrays and on land. It's a super rare phenomenon. It occurs in insects, fish, amphibians, birds, and reptiles. And Charlotte is the very first known round stingray to have undergone this type of reproduction.
I love that for her, unless she was like... Oh, Ashley.
Really,
I love how you end it. Just like, stop clapping!
Shut up, people. Go Charlotte.
I love people being like, I hope that this was, you know, divine intervention. And
oh my god,
the next coming of Christ is a stingray. I saw people commenting being like, you know, abort mission. there's been a mistake. I am accidentally a stingray.
Guys,
I can't breathe out of water.
Thought I was coming back to save the sinners.
And
but turns around, I guess, I'm just going to be stuck in a tank in North Carolina.
Exactly.
For
well,
my
that's
short
the thing,
stingray
like,
life.
She could save the ocean. True. But not if she's stuck in an aquarium.
We got to set her free, or we at least have to set her spawn free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then that's rude. They're her only friends, apparently.
Apparently, yeah. Does she have other females in the tank, or do you just stick this lonely stingray in this tank to be alone forever? Who does she even talk to? The sharks? Doubt
sharks
it.
Have different DNA. Why is she going to talk to them?
I don't know. I talk to my cats all the time, and they have different
DNA. I know.
DNA.
I talk to dogs all the time because they're so cute, and their faces are fluffy, and they have fluffy butts.
You know, my last squish them and rub them against my face, and then I can't breathe, and my eyes get really red.
It's so worth it because they're so cute.
My last strange news story, another reason why flying is the worst. A Delta flight was forced to turn around an hour after takeoff on Tuesday, February 13th, when a passenger suitcase that contained rotting fish was in the overhead bin and it opened up, resulting in maggots falling onto the passengers.
Oh my God! Why? Why? Oh my God! Oh my God! Oh my God! Oh my God!
Yeah.
Oh no!
No,
oh,
it's no. The worst. It's
oh my
the
God.
Worst.
Oh no, I'm sorry. I know I'm being really dramatic. I'm not playing
You're
this
not
up.
Being
I
really
hate...
dramatic. You are not.
Oh,
this is
no,
an accurate
why...
reaction to this
so
story.
So many questions. Why do you have rotting fish?
Why?
Why is it so
How?
Rotten that there's
Did
maggots?
It get on
why
there?
Would you put that in your suitcase? Where were you traveling from? How long has the fish been in
Amsterdam.
There? Why would you bring that on a plane?
I had the answer to one question. They were traveling from Amsterdam to somewhere in the United States. I want to say Boston. And yeah, so one of the passengers noticed that a maggot had fallen onto her blouse and alerted the flight attendants. And by that time, like other people sleeping around her were being woken up and they had maggots on them. And the owner of this nasty rotting fish bag was detained as everyone else deboarded the flight, but there have been no updates to tell us if he or she will face any consequences. Why they brought this nasty fish on an 8-hour flight and why you would even have a fish that was so rotted there were maggots in it. Like, what is even why? Because I know that there are like some delicacies that are like rotten fish and shit. Right? Am I wrong about that?
No. But I think they're mostly in like Nordic countries.
Yeah, and I don't think there's maggots inside. So I don't know.
No, I don't think so. And the thing about maggots is they're fly larvae. So if they just took a bunch of fish and put it in a suitcase, there wouldn't be maggots in it because flies wouldn't get to it. So they had to leave the fish out. And then pack it in a suitcase after flies
got to it.
And my fists are balled up.
Yeah,
because
sorry.
I'm ready to beat up the person that did that.
Yeah, I hope I never learn their name because I will find them.
I would have, oh man, I would have punched them
right in the nose.
So many times. And like, how far into the flight were they when this happened?
Not far. Like, they had flown, they had to turn around 2 hours into the flight.
So they had to spend another 2 hours?
Yeah, on the fish
so
and
four
fish
hours.
Flight. Four
and
hours.
And then they didn't even
and they
get
end
back
up
home.
Right fucking back in Amsterdam. And a bunch of them lost their luggage in this kerfuffle. So their luggage didn't even make it back to the States. I would be so mad. I would be so mad. Like, flying is already such a fucking terror for me. I don't like traveling. I don't like flying, especially don't like flying. And you add a midair turnaround and maggots. Ugh, I'm so mad. Yeah, and the people that were like close to it had to inspect their bags to make sure maggots didn't get in. It's a whole thing. Ooh, a little sneak preview of my soundboard in action. I wish I could tell you that I didn't hit the applause button 4 times during this hour-long episode, but I did. And honestly, no regrets. One thing I do regret, however, is being 2,000 miles away from Los Angeles in January when two of my favorite people of all time got to join Lauren on the Patreon. Lauren's parents! Jane and Jeff got to visit her this winter, and while they were there, they decided to hook up a mic and talk about something weird. It's one of my favorite bonus episodes of all time, and I'm not even in it, okay? So that's saying something. Here's a sneak peek.
You do have an experience in a little place called Kentucky. Which actually, Ashley and I love Kentucky because lots of strange occurrences have happened there regarding the documentary that we talk endlessly about, Hellier, on this show. And we even got to interview the people who made that documentary, and it was the most starstruck, best moment of our lives. But anyway, Kentucky has weird stuff. There's goblins, there's caves of mystery, there's all kinds of things. Oh. So it's not...
So... I'll start off by saying, yeah, we were on a road trip, and I'm sure it was probably back and forth from Florida to Illinois, or maybe North Carolina, where my sister lives, doesn't matter. But we had stopped periodically in Paducah and just stayed in a hotel. Well, this day, instead of just going to the hotel and crashing, we had a little bit of extra time. So we went down to the riverfront. We went to their downtown, and they do have parts that they have renovated and has become, you know, kind of nice in terms of shops and residents. But we were walking down one particular street that was maybe not as robust and didn't seem to be very active.
Yeah, it was a older part of town, some really old buildings, and... We were just walking by, and I noticed, I was just looking up in the building, maybe a two-story building, and I was looking up in this window, and there was like this weird-looking mannequin staring at me. And I was like, look up there. What is that? It was just looked like a mannequin, and I took a picture of it, and we're like, oh, that's just really... creepy. And then we continued our walk and visited other little shops. And then on our way back.
Well, and I'm not so sure that it's even like, you know, coming around the block a half hour later or whatever. My recollection is kind of like it was, and like Lauren said, I don't have a lot of these experiences that I can recall at least, but this one was, something was off about this mannequin. And so I almost sort of remember, whether I'm making it up or not, that we just got a little further down the street and then was going to take a last look at this weird looking mannequin before we went around the corner, and it was gone.
That's, nope.
And the, like and, the building was boarded up. No access, you know, at the lower level, street level, the door was boarded. I mean, it was just sort of a decrepit building that just looked like they had stuff stored in the upstairs
room. Abandoned, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there wouldn't have been somebody working there moving the mannequins around because the store's about to open.
The logical part of me, and if I want to say, oh, I can explain that, maybe somebody's owns that building, has nothing else to do. They sit up there and play pranks on people. But what I've told Lauren and Jane is that, yes, I don't have a lot of history. I usually can explain it. This felt really weird to me. Like, I was just like, there's something wrong with that mannequin. And then it was gone.
Yeah, it made both of you guys feel strange when you looked up at it. Yes. It wasn't just your classic pretty little lady or whatever.
Because we didn't see anyone else up in that window, like, moving around.
Yeah. No light, no activity.
Dressing.
Just a bizarre mannequin looking out at you.
Yeah.
And then it was gone.
And we cannot find the picture that I took. I have all my pictures are on my computer, and I cannot find anything about Paducah, actually.
You didn't find anything from Kentucky, their stop at all. The photos vanished because the mannequin deleted them. Off the evil mannequin from the abandoned store.
Paducah has a really awesome flood mitigation wall, and it has been filled with
murals,
and many of them are quite good, and so that's a tourist attraction. And we walked along there and took many pictures of all the different murals, but the mannequin lady took those also.
She deleted all memory of Paducah.
There's no record of us being in Paducah. I bet if I tried to find, like, the hotel reservation or something, it's gone also.
I mean, probably. I'd put nothing past creepy mannequin lady.
We have to go back.
You have to go back?
I kind of don't want to.
I know. I'm scared for you. Is Paducah a small town?
Relatively. Okay. It's really close to the border between Kentucky and Illinois.
Okay.
So, there's not a whole lot to it. But it's right on the interstate. It's right on the river.
Okay.
So it has a history of river commerce. And now it's a place to get off the interstate, maybe stay in a hotel, get something to eat, whatever.
Or don't stay in a hotel because of creepy man.
At your own risk. So,
have you guys heard of the term Uncanny Valley before?
No.
Yes.
Uncanny Valley?
Uncanny Valley is this theory, this new term that I feel like has just kind of come around in the last...
It's a concept.
A concept in the last, 5 years or so, or at least that's when I discovered it. Somebody can write in and prove me wrong, but Uncanny Valley is a term that describes the relationship between the human-like appearance of a robot or a mannequin or a doll or, you know, some visual you see in a movie or TV show, and the emotional response that it evokes. So in this phenomenon, people feel a sense of unease or even revulsion in response to humanoid robots or objects, where it's like you're almost human, but you're not, and it makes me uncomfortable. My example for this is the movie The Polar Express, which Alex gets mad at me for because he loves that movie, but I can't watch it because I think those kids and all the characters just look so weird because they're almost human, but they're just creepy. So I wonder if the mannequin was giving you that kind of reaction where it was like, you're sort of like a person, but awful.
Well, and then I find that interesting because you're trying to describe the mannequin and put it in a category, but we don't even know if it was there, actually.
I know. There's no photo evidence.
We can't really even say exactly what happened.
Were you both in a shared hallucination or a dream?
Right.
Who knows? Well, the evil witch deleted all the photos, so we'll never get to see the murals.
But that, as Lauren kind of introduced that topic, that's the only one that I recall. And if Jane has others from childhood, I don't think when we talked about it, she does either. But that's one that I just found really strange.
Yeah, and can't really explain it.
And somebody might say, no big deal to me. That's true. But from a credibility standpoint, there's a thousand other things that happened that I'm like, that's no big deal. It's a coincidence. Right. But that made me feel weird.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you should always read into those feelings. If something made you feel bad or that has a weird energy about it, there's a reason you're feeling this.
That's exactly how it felt.
Just stared at us.
I don't like it.
Okay. Fuck mannequins in windows, though, for real. One time in grade school, we went to see The Rage Carrie 2 at our local movie theater, which was old as shit. Like, it was so old. I'm pretty sure it got condemned and like that's why it shut down. But anyways, the bathroom was on the top floor and across the street was another old creepy building. And I remember there was this like mannequin in the window with one hand raised up like it was waving. And literally we tried waving back like, hello, do you need help? Are you trapped there? Just a mannequin though. Or was it? Lauren also got a few of our friends gathered to tell some of their personal run-ins with ghoulies, and here is a really, really lovely one from our good friend Madigan, the host of Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist and co-producer of the new podcast, Still Learning. Maddie stopped in to tell us a very sweet story about her grandma, and you know how much we love grandma stories. Here is a clip from the episode, I Got Friends in Low Places.
Hi, Lauren, Ashley, and all of you weirdos. My name is Madigan, and I am a podcast producer and host. My show is Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist, and I also produce a show called Still Learning with my friend India Oxenberg. Check them out if you want to, or don't. I'm here to tell you my ghost story, and this ghost was my grandma. This is my grandma on my mom's side, and she was just such a lovely lady, but unfortunately, from the time that I was born through the time that she died, I really only knew her as being blind and deaf and having dementia, but for some reason, I was her favorite grandchild, although she would never, ever, ever verbally admit that to anyone. I was like the first granddaughter after like fucking 20 boys being born into the family. And so she was just very, very a part of my mom's pregnancy and me being born. And just we always had this really, really special bond. I love my Nana. She was the fucking best. And she lived this way until I was 12 years old, like I mentioned, and then she passed away. My grandma died where she had lived for most of my life, which is at my Aunt Margaret's house in her old bedroom. It was very peaceful. It was very loving. There was no sort of tragic death situation. She was 91 years old. All is well, right? So after my grandma passes away, my Aunt Margaret decides that she's going to sell the house. And they find a young couple with a little boy and they move into the house and all is well and good still. But then all of a sudden, this little boy starts saying some kind of interesting things like, I had a bad dream last night, but then the old lady said everything was okay and I went back to sleep. And the parents are like, is this an imaginary friend? What's going on? But then the parents started noticing some other things too, like candles being blown out, lights being turned off after they went to bed, and a very distinctive perfume smell. And this little boy kept saying things about this old lady. And I was 12 at the time this happened. I'm sure my mom has more details than I do, but after these things started happening for a while, the woman that owned the house called my aunt and was like, hey, by the way, did somebody pass away here or something? Because there's been some strange things happening. And my aunt said, yes, my mother, Hildegard, passed away there, you know, shortly before we sold you the house. It was very peaceful. There was no murders or anything. And this woman was like, well, I think she's still here. And it's so funny because my mom's side of the family is like super, super Catholic. You would not think that they would give any thought to the supernatural in this sense at all. My mom's eldest sister was a nun for a little bit, and Margaret, who was the one that took care of my grandma, definitely should have been a nun, yet she took this totally seriously and kind of convened with the rest of her siblings and was like, this is what's going on. So they decided that they were going to hold a séance because they really, really wanted my grandma to finally pass on and be with my grandfather, who she missed so, so much in those years after he passed away. So I want to say one of them called a psychic or something, and they got together in a circle and did this séance with this psychic on the line. I remember asking my mom if I could go because I wanted to be a part of this so bad. And she was like, no, you're too young. This is just for the siblings. And I was like, damn it. But anyway, I guess this psychic was telling them that my grandma felt like this little boy needed her in some way. So my mom and my aunts and uncle were trying to essentially just be like, hey, you know, this little boy is going to be okay. You can pass on and be with dad. It's all right. And the psychic actually said some interesting things about my grandfather as well. They were saying that they saw a man that was fitting his description in front of a certain type of small airplane, which made sense because he used to love either flying or being there with my cousin who was a pilot. So all of this lined up and the psychic was like, he's waiting for her. And oh my gosh, it's just like the sweetest afterlife love story ever. So hopefully my mom and my aunts and uncle encouraging my grandmother to pass on and know that this little boy was going to be okay actually worked, and she passed on to be with my papa. And as for myself during this time, I was really, really grieving the loss of my grandma. I actually gave her eulogy at her funeral. It was just a whole thing. And I missed her so much. And I felt kind of jealous that this little boy got to see her and I didn't. But I was terrified that she was just going to like show up in my bedroom and scare me. So I would like pray to her at night and be like, Grandma, I miss you so much. But don't come visit. Don't come visit. Don't come visit. But I just really love that story because there's so many scary ghost stories out there, and I take care of a lot of kids. So whenever they're like, oh, it's a ghost, it's a ghost. And I'm like, well, they can be friendly ghosts. They can be comforting and they can be your friends. They don't have to be scary. You can make them into whatever you want them to be. And I always like to think of my grandma being a friendly ghost. All right, that is my only weird story, but my future mother-in-law has a shit ton of them. So Lauren and Ashley, let me know if you ever want to do one of these bonus episodes again, and I'll bring a microphone over there and we'll get some really interesting, spooky ghost stories.
Gosh, I love Madigan's voice. Make sure you check out her podcast and give her a follow on your socials. You will not regret it. At She's Madigan and at Angry Neighborhood Feminist. We've finally come to our last clip, and it's going to lead us out today. Amy and I are back with a weird report, and this was from a portion of an episode titled An Echo Chamber of Curse Words, and you are about to find out why. Keep an eye on our social media as we slowly crawl out of our hiatus cave, blinking our eyes as we adjust to the sunlight. We will keep everyone posted on when to expect our first episode. And in the meantime, Avi, keep it weird. This story that I have is just so funny to me, and probably something that's really common for zookeepers to deal with, but I've actually never considered it before now, before I read this article.
Okay.
So there's a park in Eastern England. It's called the Lincolnshire Wildlife Park. They take care of...
It's so British.
It's so British. I have a quote to read later, too. That's like the most British thing I've ever heard. They take care of 100 African gray parrots. Parrots. I said parents.
I thought you said parrots.
Oh, good. Well, maybe I didn't have to correct myself, but I definitely said parents. I smoked a little weed before we recorded. There,
Ashley.
Well.
It's illegal.
It's a Monday. Federally.
It's Monday. Monday is weed day.
Monday's weed day. No, I was stressed out. Anyways, okay. So they take care of 100 African gray parrots. 92 of them are in Gen Pop, okay? But there are 8 of them that have to be held in isolation for rehabilitation. They are not being rehabilitated because they're injured. They have to be rehabilitated because they curse so much.
Well, that's rude that they just are keeping them away from everybody else. They're fucking parrots. They don't know.
Absolutely. And like they have to keep them separated from the other 92 parrots because they could teach the other 92 parrots these words. And then you have 100 parrots
who are just saying the most vile shit. Because apparently, this is the quote I was talking about. If you're wondering, like, how bad can these parrots be? The park's chief executive, Steve Nichols, told CNN, the language that came out of their carrying boxes when they arrived was phenomenal. Really bad. Not normal swear words. These were proper expletives. Apparently, three out
apparently.
Of
the...
Apparently. Apparently. Three out of the eight of them aren't so bad, but five out of the eight of them are like you wouldn't believe the shit that is coming out of their mouths. And I wish they gave us an example. Yeah, I want to know what these fucking parrots say.
Yeah, they need to tell me if it's like fucking hard R's.
Yeah, like, what are we talking about here?
Because if it's just like, well, they say fuck a lot, it's just like, all right, man, that's gonna happen. But if it's terrible slurs.
Well, I read somewhere too that I read in another article that one of the parrots makes like sex sounds.
Ugh.
Yeah. And he was saying that, like, okay, so this is something I never thought about either. So three of the parrots talk in a female voice and five of the parrots talk in a male voice, and they don't coincide with the sex of the bird. Obviously they coincide with whoever taught the bird how to talk.
Mm-hmm.
So like there can be a male parrot that has a female voice and a female parrot that has a male voice. I've never thought about this before. It blew my mind picturing these parrots. And the problem is, so they're trying to rehabilitate them, and to rehabilitate them you basically just have to teach them a bunch of good sounds and like right. fun sounds and happy sounds, and then slowly like integrate them into general population and hope that they've kind of forgot all those horrible sounds that they learned wherever they were before they got adopted by this park. And and then they don't teach all the other parrots these horrible, horrible words. The park already does have large signs warning visitors about the parrot's language, because even the 92 and Jet, like, they can say anything. They can pick up anything you say to them. And apparently curse words are really easy for parrots to repeat. Like, the reason that it's easy is because, like, when you say curse words, you're usually saying them in the same, with the same, like, inflection. So, like, fuck, shit, damn it, you know what I mean? So, like, it's very easy for them to pick up on it because it's a word that's usually said, like, it's just one word, and it's usually said the same. So, apparently, cursing is, like, really, really easy for parrots to pick up.
I love that.
So now there are eight parrots in isolation. Well, they still live a very happy life, but they just have to live in their own enclosure that isn't open to the public because they are dirty, dirty birds.
Is their life that happy? They live in England.
Do they get fish and chips?
Oh.
Do they get fish and chips in there?
Oh, is it gonna rain today? Yeah.
Yeah. What?
Isn't it?
It's doing my head in.
Do you wanna go and get a twirly swizzle do? down at the takeaways.
You're so
you mean a hot stupid. Dog?
You mean a hot dog at the hot dog cart? No,
twirly swizzle do. Now I'm just doing Australian.
Anyways, here's hoping to a very happy and easy integration, and that this park isn't full of horrific language.
Well, how long have these birds been separated from all of their brethren?
Well, three of them just came in, like, end of last year. Five of them came in 2020.
Well... give
so
up.
They have not had a lot of luck, apparently, with getting these birds to stop cursing.
They are not talking to these birds enough. They're in an echo chamber of swears. And so they're all just swearing at each other constantly. I mean, I guess now I get it. Oh, man.
Do you have another one? Do you have another news story?
Yes. Okay, so a Kentucky city has come up with a very interesting campaign to promote tourism. This is a sort of animal story.
Oh.
The Lexington Convention and Visitors Bureau has used an infrared laser to beam a message into space to invite extraterrestrials to Lexington. The first thing you will notice as you descend through Earth's atmosphere above central Kentucky is the lush green countryside that surrounds Lexington's vibrant city center. That's our famous bluegrass. The message begins, and it goes on to describe gentle rolling hills, horse farms, and bourbon before suggesting places to stay and eat and shop. The idea for the campaign came because of, you know, people going, hey, can we have universal healthcare? And the government being like, no, did you hear that we have UFOs and they're real? Please focus on that. And then nobody cared. But some people cared. And so because of that, they also have advances in deep space imaging. Okay. And so now they're like, all right, well, we're not alone in the universe. And so we are going to reach out to the aliens. And the agency worked with scientists and scholars to beam the message towards some planets in the TRAPPIST-1 solar system, which is 40 light years away.
Okay.
And so apparently this was led by a local native to Lexington, Robert Loader, who's an expert in computer engineering, astrobiology, and search for extraterrestrial intelligence. That is the name of the thing that he is an expert in. So he said, we brought together experts in engineering, linguistics, digital media, philosophy, and science fiction to design, debate, and transmit this message. The message was sent with FAA approval and has a coded bitmap image. And the bitmap image is the key to everything because they included imagery representing the elements of life, the Kentucky rolling hills, the structure for water, the molecular structure for water, bourbon, and dopamine, because Lexington is fun. However, that's a quote. That's him talking. That's not me saying that. Nothing personal to Lexington. I'm sure it's lovely. Central Kentucky is gorgeous. It gets a bad rap. So it could take a while to hear back, though, because it is going to take 40 years for the light to travel to the planets that it's directed towards.
Oh, geez. Okay.
And then if they get the message and want to respond also with a light message, that'll take another 40 years.
Okay, well, man, imagine creating something that you know, like literally putting your heart and soul and creating this thing that you won't even know, like, if it worked.
Yeah.
That's like, what's that quote about like planting a tree that you know you'll never get to sit in the shade of?
Oh. <There's>... I don't know, like, what?
There's something about, like, as generations grow, like, you plant the trees even though you know you won't get to enjoy the fruit and you won't get to enjoy the shade because it's for the people that come after you.
Mm.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds right. It kind of makes me think of the people who worked on, what's it called, the Voyager and then the other one, and they sent them both out.
Yeah.
To leave the solar systems. And they sent them in like 1977. And one of them just left the solar system. And the other one is not going to leave the solar system for another few years.
That's so freaking wild. Guys, yeah, I bet plenty of the scientists who did that were dead.
There's too much space in space. I wonder how fast it's going. I feel like last time, I don't know why this is sticking in my head, but I feel like 37,000 miles is sticking in my head. So maybe that's how fast it's going per hour. But that does sound ridiculous. But it is space. Everything's very fast in space.
Seems like it. Except sound.
Yeah, I guess there's no sound in space.
No.
Which doesn't make any sense.
No, nothing makes sense.
How is there no sound in space? Because you can hear the astronauts. when they talk.
I guess it doesn't travel through
I don't know. Because I know that there's no sound in space for two reasons. One, the tagline to Alien is "No in space, no one can hear you scream." Two.
Well, okay.
Two, I did hear that, like, if we could hear the sun, we would go deaf. Like, that's yeah. how loud the roaring from the sun would sound, even at the distance that we are at. But because there's no sound in space, we don't have to listen to that thing churn and burn.
Well, but also, it is 93 million miles away.
It's so far.
Maybe it does make a noise, but we just are too far away.
But if a tree falls in the woods...
Really far away...
Really far away,
then you can't hear it,
and there's no one there to hear it. Does it make a sound?
Well, I feel like the sun still makes a sound even if we can't hear it,
because we're watching it all the time, because we keep our eyes on it.
Can't they just take a microphone, stick it out in space,
stick it out there,
and then also stick a boombox
and see what out in back.
Space, and then play things on the boombox?
What would you play?
And then listen to the recording. What would I play?
I think I'd play, like, Grooves in the Heart.
Oh, boom, I was going to say, boom, 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 boom. Oh, gosh.
What?
Little Richard. I'll play Tuna Fruity. Feel
on my back. Give me feel satisfaction when we're done. Satisfaction, I've just begun. I couldn't ask for another.
For another.
I'll do a mashup of Tutti Frutti and Little the Groove is in the Heart, and we'll yeah. put that in outer space.
Oh. We're going to dance.
And have some fun.
Dig.